This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. We've all been rocked over the past couple of days with news about the shooting of so many young kids at an elementary school in South Central Texas. Of course, this kind of devastating event hits teachers and students particularly hard. It's also by no means the first time we've seen mass shooting casualties at a school in this country, from Columbine to Sandy Hook and UC Santa Barbara, Parkland in South Florida. Young people in school and their teachers have had to not only hear all news like this, but they've also had to think about and prepare to react should something like that happen in their own schools. Well, two teachers we've spoken to often on this program are back with us today. Christy Collette is a third grade teacher at Newcastle Elementary in Reseda. Hi, Christy.
Hey, Steve.
And Aviva Alvarez-Zaxon, world history and ethnic studies teacher over at Hamilton High School. Ms. Z, welcome back to you.
Hi, nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to y'all. I wish it were under happier circumstances, and I can't even imagine what some of the conversations are. Christy, the shooting took place at an elementary school. You teach kids of that age, young kids. What have the last couple of days been like for you dealing with this news?
For my grade level, several of the kids have asked me about it. Several of the kids have not heard anything of it. But it's really, really hard to have a conversation, where you can't promise them that you can keep them safe.
Yeah.
I can't offer that to them.
When they ask you about what happened as a teacher, what do you say?
Luckily, none of my kids really asked me that. I know the fifth grade teachers had a little more specifics. Mine, I just had a few of the kids tell me, you know, my mom really wants me to have my phone in class. Fine, no problem. But I feel like the majority of mine, they don't really get it. They don't really grasp how serious it is.
Do you fear for your life when you go to school?
So this is the first time I've ever done an interview with you where I thought I could maybe get in trouble for something I'm going to say. So we have some instances happening at our school right now where there are some major, major red flags. And the teachers are saying, look, please, something is going to happen. And no one is listening to us. And we don't know what to do.
What are the red flags?
Unfortunately, that I can't get into that much for confidentiality reasons. But a student that we know has access to guns. And it's just not a good situation.
And you've gone to your hires up and said, this is a problem. This could be a problem.
Yes.
And nobody's done anything about it?
Yes.
The principal, the school district?
No one is listening to us.
What do you do then as a teacher who is in that classroom to prepare yourself to secure your classroom, those souls that are in there with you?
You know, it's, we all now keep our doors locked all the time.
The classroom doors.
The classroom doors. I used to go to lunch, I would leave my door open. No, we can't do that anymore. All of our doors only lock from the outside. So were there an actual emergency and you needed to lock the door, you would have to go outside to lock the door. It's a major flaw. Something as simple as that. The door should lock from the inside.
Have you thought about leaving your job because of these issues? Because of, the problem child, the threats that perhaps is there, the safety issues, the people who aren't hearing what you're saying?
I personally have not, because I love my job. I love being in the classroom with my students. I would hate to leave, but I know a lot of people who are ready to go.
Ms. Z, Aviva, you teach high school. Your students are very much aware of what's going on in the world around them. Many of them have cell phones. Many of them have been talking, obviously, about what's been going on. Have you been talking with your kids, your students, about what happened in Texas?
Absolutely. I feel, first I want to say, Christy, I'm so sorry that you're going through that at your campus. That sounds, the thing I said, that a bureaucratic nightmare is a nightmare. And that's what sounds like is happening, is that it's just getting lost in bureaucracy. In terms of my students, of course, I talk to them about it. I'm very upfront and open when things like this happen in the news, because my students have voiced over and over again that they don't really like it when we just teach around or just teach through. We have to address and let them know that, yes, we are affected by this. And yes, we are listening to you if you need to hear from us. We had announcements go up. We had our wellness center open for students who needed somewhere to talk or someone to talk to. And I whenever something like this happens in the news, I always do a warm up or a bell ringer, as some people call it. And I always have the option when something like this happens for students to just use the space instead of doing the typical warm up to reflect or to ask questions or to just say what's on their mind or what they are feeling. And just give them the opportunity to just have that space privately. And of course, publicly, if they feel the need to talk about it.
Christy, talking about safety, a lot of schools have the drills with kids about, you know, what to do if there's a shooter on campus. Is the school going back to those or are taking other special precautions right now?
You know, we have never had specifically like an active shooter drill. We've practiced lockdown drills, which is done under the assumption that someone in the office is going to be able to get onto the PA and call a lockdown, which in a real emergency like this, that might not even be an option. And there really isn't a plan. It's, you know, I have read on my own that one of the things that they recommend is not staying locked on campus. And if you have the opportunity to get off of campus, that you should go. And, you know, my classroom just happens to be right by a side gate. And, you know, I know that's not district policy, but is that something that I would do? Are we running out the gate to somebody's house down the street?
How about Hamilton High, Ms. Z?
Hamilton High School is a really big school. We've had lockdowns. We've had drills. And we've also done the other safety drills. But we're such a huge campus that I think for me, it's important to kind of make the point that, like, there is, we have to consider the balance here, because the active shooter drills, lockdown drills have also been found to traumatize students into being really, really scared. Like, that's part of the fear, is these drills. And so how do we balance being prepared with not unnecessarily traumatizing our students? I think Christy makes a really good point with, like, so if there is an emergency, I don't think our school system is prepared, period. We have hundreds of thousands of students in our district. If there was an emergency, like think of an earthquake, right? The reunification process after an earthquake or a fire or a major fire is very similar to what the reunification process would look like after some kind of extreme lockdown or active shooter incident. It is a very similar reunification process. And if that isn't working for any degree, then it's not going to work in any emergency situation. And then with that also, with high schools our size, an incident happening on the north end of campus might not be heard or known on the south end of campus if there isn't any strict communication. It was a couple years ago before COVID where we had a kind of scary incident occur. I can't remember the details of it. There's just been so many in the news and in real life. But me and I have just teacher friends on other parts of the campus. And we were just like, okay, if anything ever happens, I will text you. And it's just these individual lines of communication. just to check in on each other. So we have created our own systems, and then we do what we can to have, you know, phone trees and things like that. We have like group chats ready to go to communicate these things. But of course, always there's that fear is like, what if it collapses? And similar to Christy, my classroom is not too far from a gate, not a gate that I have a key to though. Not a gate that I could open, but a gate I could tell kids to jump over. That's where my head always goes is if somebody were to try to harm my campus, I will tell my students, if you are physically able, go and jump over that fence right now.
But that's, of course, that's your job as a human being and the person who is trying to protect those, as I said, souls in your classroom. But there are responsible parties who are supposed to gather and say, this is what we have to do in the case of an emergency, in the case of a school shooting or an earthquake or whatever it may be. And it doesn't sound like a lot of that is happening.
No, at our school, it's...
Go ahead, Christy.
I was going to say, it's a similar thing with us, is that we have our own plan. It's not a school plan. As teachers, we have come up with, for our building, what are we going to do on our own?
I mean, that's kind of shocking to me. That hasn't been, because, you know, the narrative is that we have become so numb and used to these kinds of shootings and started with Columbine in the late 90s. And we saw those pictures and it's just happened over and over and over again that of course we have these drills. Of course we have a plan in case something like this happens, but it doesn't sound like 30 years, 25 years after Columbine, there's much of a plan, even in the wake of a disaster like what we saw earlier this week.
I think one, we have to remember that every plan that's ever been drafted for this is based off of, thankfully, while too common, still rare and horrific, unimaginable events. And that when these things happen, plans fly out the window. Plans do not really work under such an emergency situation. So I remember when my sister was down the street, and actually my brother was a freshman at the time, there was a plan at Santa Monica High School. I went there too. I knew what the plan would have been. My brother was in the bathroom when it happened. Plan out the window. He was not in his class. He wasn't where he was quote unquote supposed to be. And it freaked us out at the time. Right.
Yeah.
When plans go out the window when real life happens, I think there is, when we talk about like our numbness to it, we are numb from the perspective of people who are not experiencing it. We are numb from the perspective of people who would like to think we would have a plan in the moment. I think that what we need to talk about is how we respond to our students when they are experiencing the trauma of having witnessed that this happened somewhere and that they're scared it will happen to them. And it's, I think, less to do with a strict plan and more to do with, we need to have frank conversations. For example, like Christy and I talking about how like it's not in the plan that we send our kids jumping over the fence, but maybe it should be. Maybe that should just be on the list of things to suggest. Like maybe we should be talking about how there isn't going to be a plan, because if one thing goes off on that plan, it's out the window. And I guarantee you, at every single one of these incidents, something has gone off plan. And we need to be prepared for that.
I want to thank you both for coming on. Boy, there's so much going on. Aviva Alvarez-Zaxon teaches world history, ethnic studies over at Hamilton High. Christy Collette, who teaches third grade at Newcastle Elementary. Thanks to you both. Our thoughts are with you. Hang in there.
Thank you for giving this time.
Thank you, Steve.
It seems like every time one of these horrific school shootings take place, school districts have to reevaluate their security protocol. Well, LA schools say they're doing that again this time. Yesterday, the LAUSD superintendent, Alberto Cavallo, announced that the district would be conducting an access assessment to look at reducing points of entry to campuses, along with, quote, advanced technologies that identify individuals approaching the school that require some degree of vetting before the person enters the school, end quote. He says the district will also look to identify safe corner areas, places on campus where students and staff can shelter in the event of an emergency. Straight ahead on GLA, helping one community dig through the opinions and memes and social media morass to lay out factual and helpful information about COVID. That's yours on the other side of this.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The pandemic has taken a toll on so many families and communities around the world, and the Filipino community here in the United States is no exception. And access to reliable information has been a big obstacle, especially for underrepresented communities. So, one group is here to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
The Caretaker Project's Tayo Help Desk. It's a pilot program put together by the Filipino Young Leaders Program. It's an organization of young leaders from the Filipino-American community. They have created a virtual COVID-19 help desk that's accessible to Filipinos all over the country. And Lizelle Tanglao is a project director at Tayo and the president of the Filipino Young Leaders Program. Lizelle, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
The virtual help desk first started, I guess, in the heart of the pandemic, like when it first started in 2020, right? Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, the virtual help desk was really a response to try to figure out how do we help our older relatives who at the beginning of the pandemic were just not listening to us. You know, they were not social distancing. They were still going out when we were still in lockdown. So the group of us that are, you know, young professionals, we're all on a Zoom like one day and trying to figure out, well, I wish there was like a playbook to try to figure out how do we talk to our relatives, how do we have these difficult conversations. And that was really the beginning origin story of Tayo, which eventually launched fall of 2020. And since then, we've definitely iterated on the different offerings. But at the core of it, we definitely wanted to make sure that we were able to connect our community with the vital sources and resources that they needed. Also combat misinformation that we kept seeing come up over and over, and then also just improve the collection of data about us as a community. You know, with the lack of disaggregated data in the Filipino community, that often masks a lot of the problems that we may not even be aware of because we get lumped in into the larger APA group out there.
And by the way, there's a large Filipino community here in Los Angeles, right? I mean, so a lot of this is in LA.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a majority of, there's a good number of our members that are based in LA. LA alone, greater LA, there's about a little over 500,000 Filipinos here. And just nationwide, we're the third largest Asian Pacific Islander group in the U.S. at 4 million.
You said the word misinformation, and there is a lot of misinformation out there. What were you guys dealing with in trying to, you know, correct or at least get the truth out there?
In the beginning, we saw a lot of our older relatives, our aunties and uncles, like share like these memes that, like, if you recall, in the beginning of the pandemic, there were these memes that were going out like, oh, gargle hot water, you'll get rid of COVID. And, you know, we felt like, well, if those members of our community are sharing this, is there a way we can combat that by giving them something else that's also trusted that they can be sharing instead of, you know, these memes, these graphics, just these theories that are just completely false. So that's really kind of some of the things that we've been working on at Tayo, whether it's graphics or PSAs. We really are really trying to hone in on just making sure it's culturally tailored.
So y'all are the liaisons, right, between the CDC, like getting the information out there and putting it in a way that people can understand.
We would consider ourselves very much bridge people because in many ways, my peers and I, Filipino Americans, have always been bridge people, you know, basically navigating two different worlds. Many of our parents immigrated here from the Philippines. So we take that role very seriously just because, you know, obviously these are our loved ones. We're trying to take care of them and, you know, they should have access to the most accurate information.
Has there been any reluctance among your aunties and uncles, right, who maybe didn't want to reach out or felt, you know, shame in that, or, you know, I mean, there's a bit of a generational gap as well, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's always been an ongoing challenge, and which is why part of the reason we have continued with this project in different forms and fashion, just because, like, you know, like, you can only do so much to really convince somebody, but, like, I would say that you can't give up. And again, it goes back to trust. So it's like, well, what sources are they looking at? Why do they trust, you know, these people versus, you know, their own flesh and blood? So it's really kind of that ongoing kind of iteration of, like, trying to figure out, all right, well, if they see this particular resource or person as trustworthy, then we need to figure out what is working there that we can also take from there, so that making sure that they're not going down a rabbit hole that is can be potentially dangerous. So we definitely, that has been definitely an ongoing issue. And I know it's not just within the Filipino community alone. I think that's all different communities that are trying to address that problem.
Are you seeing a difference?
I think we're getting there. I think it's really at the heart of what we've really learned and what was been our most successful, you know, approaches is really just honing in on the storytelling aspect, because facts are facts, which is great. But if you can't approach it in a way that will be, you know, enticing, somewhat entertaining, that would resonate, it doesn't really stick.
Is the hotline going to expire? Are you going to keep it going through the pandemic? I mean, obviously, we're not done with the pandemic, and it's certainly not done with us. Are you keeping it going?
We would love to keep it going. So the hotline just recently launched this early May. This is due to a second round of funding from the Booz Allen Foundation. And that was really a response of feedback when we launched the virtual part of the help desk. We heard from a lot of our seniors. They kept asking, well, this is great, but, like, is there a number I could call? Is there somebody that I can talk to about this? So when we went for another round of funding, they decided to fund this pilot. So this is a 3-month pilot. So this will run through the end of the summer. And depending on, you know, what findings we get, we hope to continue this in some form or fashion, or at the very least, you know, knowledge share what we've learned for other communities, because there is something to be said about picking up the phone and talking to somebody, because it's also about accessibility, because not everyone has access to a smartphone or the internet. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, we weren't only thinking about the folks that are tech savvy, but, you know, our seniors that, you know, as long as they have, you know, access to this information, so that no one is left behind.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us and for what you're doing. That call center, by the way, is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific time. You can reach the center by visiting TayoHelp. That's TayoHelp.com. Lizelle Tanglao, Project Director at Tayo and the President of the Filipino Young Leaders Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us this evening. By the way, your support at KCRW, very important, and we did it. Thank you for stepping up during KCRW's Spring Pledge Drive. You can always give, by the way, at kcrw.com/give. Subscribe to the podcast while you're there as well at the radio station's website. Next week on this program, Up the Coast, Hearst Castle is back open after they shut it down for the pandemic. There's a big celebration. It's coming a wee bit late, but there is celebrating going on. You'll hear about it. That's next week on Greater LA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time and, of course, your ears. Have a great night.